The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Today, I want to talk about a topic that when I was practicing in Thailand and Burma was a frequent subject of the Dharma teaching. So frequent that after a while, I just kind of would tune out when these words were said. It was just... And now, as in recent years, I have the impression that I am starting to mention these concepts more and more frequently. And I wonder whether, as I mention them, whether I'm kind of even talking about them, kind of just kind of like, you know, glossing over them. But even more so, I'm a little concerned that you all listening to me might be like how I was in Thailand and hear these and say, oh, you know, here we go, you know, whatever. And but these are very important central teachings in the teachings of the Buddha, and things that the reason I teach them more and more is the more I value them as being really profound, more profound than I think you'll understand if you just hear what they are. So these is three words, three concepts, three movements of our minds that are called, usually referred to in English as greed, hatred, and delusion. And they've been known to show up. Occasionally, I'm sure all of us, you know, have them visiting a little bit. And they are best considered to be umbrella terms, kind of categories under which all kinds of other related mental movements are occurring. So greed is like a pretty big word, but, you know, includes the mildest kind of movement of desire in some kind of unhealthy way. So very minor. It's also, you know, something as strong as addiction and other things like that. And so I want to talk about these three a bit today. But first I would like to tell two stories. First, a story or a tale that the Buddha taught, and then an account from a conversation that is recorded in the suttas about these. So the story has to do with a creature called a yaksha, yakka in Pali. And sometimes people refer to it as kind of a tree spirit, but in my telling of the story, I like to call this creature an ugly little runt of a troll. And since I'm Norwegian, I'm allowed to. And this ugly little runt of a troll ends up going up to one of the high heaven realms where the great lord of the heavens named Brahma has a palace and a throne. But Brahma is away that day, so this little troll does something very disrespectful, and that is jumps up on Brahma's throne and sits there. Well, the other gods in the heaven up there get kind of upset, because that throne is reserved for Brahma. So they get a little bit angry, and they say, you have to get off there, that's only for Brahma. And as they get angry and express their anger, this troll gets bigger. And so, the solution then is to get more angry. And so, as they get more angry and more vehement about all this, what was an ugly little runt of a troll gets bigger and bigger and stronger and more beautiful, but stays on the throne. So, after a while, the gods get kind of perplexed and they decide to go find Brahma and ask, what are we going to, you know, tell him what's happening back home? And they tell him the story, and Brahma says, oh, okay, I know what this is about. So he goes back to his palace and walks up to the throne where this troll is sitting. And he says, greetings, dear troll. Bows to him, and says, I'm happy to see you, and how's it going? And he's very kind and supportive, friendly to the troll. And as he does that, the troll starts to shrink, gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And he just keeps being kind to him, and eventually the troll just kind of dissolves, poof, and vanishes in the air. So then Brahma gets up on his throne, and he says, explains to everyone, that was an anger-eating troll. And the more that you're angry, the bigger it gets. And so if you don't want it to be doing what it's doing, you have to stop feeding it, and being kind is one way, and then it'll dissolve and go away. Very nice, right? And so it says something about how we relate to forces like greed, hate, and delusion have a lot to do with, you know, how they continue or how they don't continue. There are ways of feeding them that will just make them bigger and bigger and kind of get caught in a spiral, in a loop of just kind of self-reinforcement. And there's ways of relating to them where they begin to unwind, settle down, weaken, and disappear. And seeing, knowing that difference is a lot to do with how the Dharma is understood. In fact, the Dharma is often sometimes said to be seen for oneself in seeing that movement, of freeing oneself from these forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. There's a wonderful little passage where there's a wonderful kind of little it's used as liturgy nowadays by monastics, and describing what the Buddha's teachings are, kind of, and they go something like this. The teachings are visible here and now of immediate result, inviting everyone to come and see, onward leading, and to be directly experienced by the wise. Then someone comes to the Buddha and says, or then the Buddha says, and how does this work this way? How are these teachings, this Dharma, immediate, visible here and now? And the Buddha says, a person who is greedy, hating, and deluded, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, aims at one's own harm, at the harm of others, at the harm of both, and that person suffers pain and grief in the mind. That person also leads a wicked way of life in actions, words, and thoughts, and one does not know one's own true benefit, that of others, and the benefit of both. Then he goes on, but when greed, hatred, and delusion are given up, one will not aim at one's own harm, at the harm of others, or at the harm of both. And one will not suffer pain and grief in one's mind. One will not lead in a wicked life, and one will understand one's own true benefit, that of others, and the benefit of both. In that sense is the teaching visible here and now of immediate result, inviting one to come and see, onward leading, to be directly experienced by the wise. So, it's pretty basic psychological to talk about that the whole teachings can be seen with the presence and then the absence of greed, hate, and delusion. It's for some people, that's not very inspiring. It's possible to think of much more lofty and inspiring teachings. In fact, not a few Buddhists will prefer wonderful teachings of emptiness, non-duality, great states of consciousness and jhanas and so forth. And kind of really look at these exalted mind states as being kind of, this is where it's really at. That's okay. But this is a powerful statement about the value of these ordinary states of mind, which are so ordinary and everyday, so pedestrian, because they're so common, that maybe it's easy to want to overlook them as having great value. So the second story I want to tell has to do with someone who comes, and I don't think it's to the Buddha. I think it's, let's see. It's a disciple of the Buddha named Ananda. So someone from another religious sect of the time comes to the Buddha's disciple Ananda. And some people read the story that is a little bit challenging Ananda, and he's using Buddhist terminology to kind of somehow challenge him. And so he comes to Ananda and says, whose teaching is well proclaimed? Who is practicing well? And who are the fortunate people? Now, if this is a kind of a religious debate, you know, it has a little bit to do with what's the really true teachings? Whose teachings are really good? You know, the most ultimate, and you know, maybe he was ready for a debate. And who are the people who are really practicing seriously and well? And what, you know, basically what practices are important? And who are the people who are really realized, who really are, you know, have some ultimate attainment? So, Ananda says in reply, well, first I say what he doesn't say. He doesn't say the Buddhist teaching is well proclaimed. The Buddhists are the ones who practice well. And the Buddhists who have attained enlightenment are the fortunate ones. He's not going to reply by championing his religion, which I think is a very significant kind of thing, that maybe somewhat unusual for some people who are involved with the religion to want to think that theirs is important and the best. So then he replies, I shall ask you a question in return, and you can answer any way you see fit. What do you think as to those who teach a doctrine for the abandoning of greed, hatred, and delusion? Is their doctrine well proclaimed or not? Or what do you think about this? And so he answers, well, I think their doctrine is well proclaimed, Reverend Sir. So it could be a little bit of a rhetorical trick, because it could be that he thinks that there are more lofty teachings, but you can't say that ending greed, hate, and delusion is something that's poorly proclaimed. You know, that's pretty good. That's, I mean, maybe, you know. And then he goes on. Ananda says, then what do you think? Those whose practice is directed to the abandoning of greed, hatred, and delusion, do they live a well-practiced life in this world or not? And the interlocutor says, I think they are living a life well-practiced. And further, what do you think? Those whom greed, hatred, and delusion are abandoned, cut off at the root, made barren like a palm stump, brought to non-existence, no longer liable to arise in the future again, are they the fortunate ones in the world or not? Yes, I do think, Reverend Sir, that those are the fortunate ones in the world. And so this is an example of a strategy that was used in ancient India by the Buddha and others in inter-religious dialogues, where people came to challenge them about their teachings or asked about the teachings. And sometimes the Buddha would seldom champion himself, but rather would say, what do you think about this? Or point to a principle, like the principle, you know, someone will ask, who are the people who are enlightened? And the Buddha says, well, that's not really the question I want to answer. But there are people who are freed of greed, hatred, and delusion. That is what I'm interested in. So it doesn't kind of maybe satisfy every religious interest, and maybe there are more lofty states and experiences to be had. But maybe at least this should be the minimum. At least this. Don't overlook overcoming greed, hatred, and delusion on the way to something more lofty. And in fact, I've known people who've done that, and I've known people who've ended up causing tremendous harm in the world because of going and emphasizing exalted states of meditation and different things, and then not really taking care of these forces of greed, hate, and delusion, not knowing them, not knowing how to practice with them, recognizing them, not having uprooted them, and then causing harm. And then people are confused. How could someone who is considered so enlightened do these things? And it's partly because of, you know, association of enlightenment to exalted states, rather than this ethical purification that the Buddha was interested in. So one of the very interesting things about these greed, hatred, and delusion is that the Buddha called them the three roots. And they're the three roots for all unwholesome or unskillful activities, speech and action and thought. And one of the, this metaphor of roots has association that you can, if you take off, pluck off the leaves of a weed, chances the weed will keep growing. So if that's all you do, you know, it's not going to help much. Some plants, if you cut them off at the soil level, the roots will resprout. And we are dealing with poison oak at our retreat center. And it doesn't work to just take off the leaves. It doesn't work to chop them off at the ground level. If you really want to be free of poison oak and not use herbicide, you have to dig up the roots and pull them out by the roots. So the same thing with these things of greed, hate, and delusion. If you take off the outermost expressions of them, restrain yourself from acting externally in these ways, but don't really go deep inside and address the roots, those roots sooner or later can resprout like poison oak. And the association with poison oak is used partly because the Buddha called greed, hate, and delusion poisons. And they are forces within us that harm the people who have them. People who have them and act on them are burning themselves, is language he used, harming themselves. So the idea in practice is to get down deeper than what's even commonly visible. Certainly deeper than what's visible to other people and what you say and what you do, but also sometimes visible in the ordinary mind that we have. We're busy and running around. And that's one of the reasons we practice meditation, is to be able to calm and center the mind enough to really be able to look deep down in the understory, the underground, to the roots, so we can pull up the roots. Now, one of the things about the roots is that this idea of roots, that's fascinating, I think, is that in the Buddhist analysis, whenever someone does deliberately does something that be considered unethical, deliberately an expression of greed, and unethical or unwholesome or unskillful, something that deliberately causes harm in the world, it's always based on one of these three forces: greed, hatred, and delusion. And the Buddhists say that if it's greed and hatred that's the root, it always comes along with delusion. Delusion's always there with greed and hatred. I suppose delusion can be there without greed and hatred, but not the other way. And so part of the value of mindfulness is to bring the focus of attention to how these work in us. And rather than thinking of this as being bad news and depressing, this is the way of becoming free of them. This is the way to learn how not to feed these things. Because the unexamined mind, when a mind is left alone without any attention, will all too easily feed the troll that we have. It's all too easy to get caught up in these very impulsive and powerful authoritative forces within us, of greed in all its varieties, of hatred in all its varieties, some quite mild, and in delusion in all its ways. So what we're asked to do with mindfulness practice is not just see it kind of in the abstract, but to really feel how these work. And I put a lot of value on this idea of feeling, which means to really experience it somatically. Not just abstractly or as ideas, but so how does it feel in your body when you're caught in the grips of a very, very compulsive desire, something you strongly want? What does it feel somatically when you're caught in ill will towards anyone? What does it feel somatically to be caught in delusion? And it's possible over time to get more and more familiar with what this feels like. You can feel the physical, the feeling of being impelled or feeling of compulsion that some of them come with. It's possible to feel the fire of them, the agitation that they bring, and it's possible to feel, especially with delusion, the ways in which they cloud the mind or cloud our sight, how we're seeing the world through the filter of ideas rather than seeing it directly. And many people wonder, how am I going to know what delusion is? It's so hard. I'm deluded, so how could I know? I think, again, this almost somatic way of really understanding how perception works, you can feel the distance that delusion brings between you and what you're perceiving, what you're relating to. There's no direct contact, no direct seeing, no direct kind of sensing and experiencing the thing, but we actually can feel how we're seeing through a veil of ideas, of concepts. And surprisingly enough, even non-deluded ideas, because some of us are very wise, even wise ideas can create distance because we're living in the concepts rather than seeing directly. And a huge part of mindfulness is learning to know what it's like to perceive, to experience in a very direct, immediate way without the filter of concepts. As we learn somatically what that feels like, then we can feel and see the arising of a concept in the mind and see if it creates distance or helps us be more connected to the experience. As we begin to feel somatically more, then things like greed, hatred, and delusion are felt to be a drag. The way that they drain us, the way in which they create stress and agitation, the way that we become so clear that after a while, and if any of you are economically inclined, the cost-benefit analysis is not in their favor. That the benefits that you get, that you're trying to get, and most people are trying to get some benefit when they're acting out of greed, hate, and delusion, that benefit is not worth it. It causes more problems in the short term and more problems in the long term than really makes sense to live with and be with. And then to somatically have the experience of what the opposite of greed, hate, and delusion are like. To feel what it's like to have non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. And appreciate that, value that. Non-greed is, it's a category word for a whole bunch of positive mental states that a person can have. Most commonly, it's kind of in shorthand, or you know, first mentioned often is generosity. Non-hatred, what's mentioned first, is usually love or kindness or compassion. Non-delusion, it's wisdom. And these also can appear kind of abstract, and if you mention these concepts too often, people fall asleep and don't understand, don't appreciate how valuable they are, how important they are. But if we have a somatic reference point for them and feel the goodness of them or the warmth and the freedom, the delight, the ease that they come with, then it's kind of almost like a natural thing to move in those directions. when we do the cost-benefit analysis, it's clear that living a life based on forces like generosity and kindness and wisdom just brings so much more benefit to ourselves and others. It's really worth it. Even at times, maybe in the short term, it seems like it's just too, it takes too much work, or, it's easier just to snap at someone and get them to go away. So, to be mindful, then, of the ways that these strange words, greed, hatred, and delusion, work for you. And you might have to choose different words, because some of us don't think of ourselves that way, but there might be other ways that kind of synonyms or words in their family that work better for you. And so you're welcome to figure out different words for it. And whatever seems helpful for you. Let me see if the ancient texts in Buddhism come up with all these kind of synonyms or related words. If I can find it quickly, I'll read it. And here we go. So you're not going to agree with all these words, but as you listen to them, just think of them when they operate in you in ways that make you tight or caught up in them or compulsive or operate in you in such ways that they're easily, different words for desire, greed. What happens to you when you're frustrated in your desires? It might be your desire is reasonable, but when it's not fulfilled, that's often a cause for hatred, for ill will. So how do these work in you as these unwholesome roots? So greed, liking, wishing, longing, fondness, affection, attachment, lust, cupidity, craving, passion. I'm only halfway through. Should I stop? Self-indulgence, possessiveness, avarice, desire for the five sense objects, desire for wealth, offsprings, fame, etc. Hatred, dislike, disgust, revulsion, resentment, grudge, ill humor, vexation, irritability, antagonism, aversion, anger, wrath, and vengefulness. Delusion, stupidity, dullness, confusion, ignorance of what is essential, for example, the Four Noble Truths, prejudice, ideological dogmatism, fanaticism, wrong views, and conceit. And then to end on a positive note, I thought we would do then the commentarial list for the what's called the wholesome roots, the good roots. So non-greed, unselfishness, liberality, generosity, thoughts and actions of, this, here it says, sacrifice and sharing, renunciation and dispassion. Non-hatred, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, friendliness, forgiveness, and forbearance. And non-delusion, wisdom, insight, knowledge, understanding, intelligence, sagacity, discrimination, impartiality, and equanimity. So, my hope in giving this talk was to highlight the value of these pedestrian states and how profound they are for the teachings of the Buddha, because I don't know anything that's more profound in terms of a spiritual life or a wise life than understanding and eradicating the roots of the ways that we cause harm to ourselves and to others. And I know nothing more profound than knowing how to act from the roots, from the force inside of us, that operate for the benefit of ourselves and the benefit for others. This is a beautiful thing to consider and be part of. And I hope that as a community here, that we can live together in ways that benefit each other. And that for those of you who stay for the potluck, and I hope all of you stay, that you think of the food that's been offered by people who've offered some food as coming from their generosity and their non-greed and for non-hatred, and that that food, metaphorically, is nourishing the forces inside of you of non-hatred, non-greed, and non-delusion. So thank you.